Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined once again by John Endres. John, thank you for being back on the show again today.
Thank you. It's a rare privilege. Thank you for inviting me back.
Always good to have you on. We are also joined today by Sara Gon. Sara, how are you? How are you doing today?
I'm well, and excuse if you hear a little bit of angle grinding. It's the mellifluous sound of building in this in the suburban environment that I have no control over.
At the moment, there doesn't seem to be anything, but we will keep that in mind.
Thanks.
And hopefully there isn't any, but I'm sure we can appeal to the good people of the suburbs to stop angle grinding during the day because it's the most annoying sound ever. Anyway, let's get on to our first news story, and this is what I think is in many ways an unsurprising result, which is that the Constitutional Court has found that Jacob Zuma isn't eligible to go to Parliament, and that the Constitutional Court's finding of contempt of court against Jacob Zuma bars him from going to Parliament. I think this is kind of unsurprising. In fact, in my opinion, the thing that was really surprising about this whole case is that the Electoral Court originally ruled that Zuma could go to Parliament, which I thought was always a bit strange. But anyway, nonetheless, the IEC says that it has noted that the Constitutional Court decision clarified the Commission's role in qualifying candidates nominated to stand for election to the National Assembly. Jacob Zuma's face will remain on the ballot paper next to the MK party, but his name will be removed from the nomination list. There is also the court basically found that he's not eligible to be an MP. And that there wasn't bias against him by the IEC, which is one of the things that his lawyers had suggested. So it looks to me like this is a kind of proper outcome. The question, I guess, now is what do Jacob Zuma and his supporters do with this? There's already been some people kind of worried that there's going to be an outbreak of violence similar to the July 2021 riots. But I'm not so sure. Let me start with you, John. What do you make of the significance of this case? Do you agree with me that this was the sort of expected decision? What's your takeaway?
I think it would have been a mistake to be complacent in thinking that the Concord was going to make the call that it did make. I think it's good that it did. I think it is a vindication of the court, which sometimes seems to be getting a little bit wobbly, but I think it made the right call in this case. I think it is also good that we had a bit of a legal ding dong about this question between the IEC and the Electoral Court and now the Concord. Because it shows that there is a legal process in South Africa that applies even to really contentious political matters, and that the courts are able to apply their minds to these questions and not, just rubber stamp everything and come to automatic decisions. So it's good that there was a bit of contestation around the question, and in the end, I think the legal system arrived at the right result. For MK itself, I think it will be adept at using this as an opportunity to pump up a little bit of emotion around how terribly its leader is being treated by the courts, and how important it is for people to go and vote for MK to strengthen his base and make him more powerful, etc. So I think they'll be able to engineer a bit of a bump out of it. As you said, his face will still be on the ballot. He'll still be the leader of the party. He just won't be leading the party from Parliament. And that is quite a good thing, I think. I'm not sure if he's disbarred from taking a role in the provincial government of KZN. So would he be able to, negotiate a premiership out of a coalition deal in KZN? That I'm not sure about, but I have no doubt that whatever the possibilities are, he will maximize them to maximize his influence, his reach, and maybe also his disruptive potential. Nick.
I think that Zuma being in Parliament was never going to be really. I mean, obviously, it would have had a bit of an impact, I think, on our politics. But ultimately, Zuma is a guy of his ability to, do rallies and control politics from behind the scenes and that kind of thing. I think that's always his sort of strong point. And he's not going to be the one giving fantastic speeches in Parliament. He's always going to be the one outside of it, shouting about how it's, a Western institution that's undermining the true will of the people or something like that. Sara, what do you make of this case and the ruling? Do you agree with what John and I have said?
I agree, and I think it essentially presents a win-win because, as John says, the Constitutional Court found against him on something that I don't think he actually intended to fulfill. I think the reality is age and probably health precluded that anyway. And the one, judging by comments made, he's been missing rallies and speech giving, you know, on a regular basis. At the same time, it doesn't interrupt the election. The election goes ahead. It doesn't in any way affect the legitimacy of the election or stop it from being held for any reason. So, as I say, that's what I mean by win-win. It kind of, in a way, pleases everything and everyone. And I think what it does is also give a sort of fillip to free speech, because what the Umkhonto weSizwe's spokesperson said is, we will take control, President. Zuma does not have to be the president. He is still the brains behind any president that will be deployed. And I think that's more about the MK's manifesto than probably anything else. So have no fear. Whoever's in parliament, until they enjoy being there and want to get back control of themselves, Jacob Zuma will be sort of omnipresent.
Yeah, and because of our list system in the way our parliament works, the fact that you don't have these constituencies, it's very easy, at least relatively speaking, for a political party to essentially remove MPs that it doesn't want. So Zuma will, as long as he maintains control of the party's hierarchy, will presumably still have the ability to take out any MP who defies him within his own party there. So I suspect that his power will not be significantly diminished by this. But John, on the question of violence, I mean, we're recording this, what, a couple hours after the ruling. No sign of anything yet, but do you think any of that is legitimate in terms of potential disruptions ahead of the election?
I think not. So just based on the initial commentary we've seen out of MK, they seem to be taking the judgment and pointing out that once MK has won a two-thirds majority in the election, it will be academic in any case. So they seem to be relatively relaxed over it. And I think we should be okay. But it's good that you're raising that point, because, of course, part of the concern on the court's judgment was that it would be swayed by the threat of violence. Now, so was it going to rule in Zuma's favor because it was worried that violence was going to break out and we'd have a repeat of 2021? And it might have said, you know, we have to compromise the law to save human lives. It's a good thing that it didn't do that. I think that would be quite the wrong direction for the law to go in South Africa, for it to be compromised under threat of violence, under intimidation. Nick?
If I may go out on a bit of a limb here, I think that what we've really kind of seen a little bit from MK is also how the democratic process can work to reduce levels of violence. And let me explain what I mean. When MK first emerged, it was a lot more bellicose in its rhetoric in those very first few weeks. It had leaders who were claiming that they were going to go out and you know, destroy the country if they didn't win. I mean, there was a group supporting MK who said that if MK doesn't get 51% of the vote, that they would burn the country down, I believe is what they said. There was that youth leader who's now been reinstated but was for a time kicked out of the party's leadership, who said that, you know, he would commit violence and riots if Zuma wasn't able to go to parliament. And then I think what happened, and this is my theory, which I'd like you guys to comment on, is that once MK realized it might actually get a significant number of votes, and in this case, we're looking at anywhere between 7 and 13% of the vote, they began to see that there was actually something to play for, and that being too radical, too disruptive, and too violent was likely just to minimize their ability to get votes. And so they reeled it in, and suddenly you had the youth leader declaring that he was a man reborn, that he was no longer pursuing violence, and I believe is exactly how he put it in his speech. And suddenly MK's bellicose rhetoric was way turned down, and now they're just saying that they're confident of victory and that they're going to win control of the country. I mean, you know, there's very little evidence to suggest that that's going to happen, but they're still playing for first place in KZN. and potentially power over that province. So, John, I mean, firstly from you, what do you make of that?
Just briefly, I would say that I think one of the reasons the EFF has not been more successful is because it is associated with violence, anarchy, disruption. And so I think it helps you to get onto the scene, but if you want to stay on the scene and grow, then you need something more to offer than just that. And so much along the lines of what you just said, MK used that as a way to get into the national picture, but maybe has realized that if you want to have staying power, then you do need to offer a bit more than just that.
I think that's exactly correct. Sarah, any final thoughts before we move on?
No, I would just say I suspect that the, you know, Zuma's a very canny operator, and he would have sussed, you know, what the mood was, what the level of threat of violence could be made, when to tone it down. And I'm sure the meeting between him and the youth leader was very instructive to the youth leader. And I'm sure someone like Zuma would have very much been in control of that process and picked that up, that, you know, violence may be an attention grabber, but it's not necessarily a great vote catcher.
Now, I don't think it means that MK has suddenly, you know, become a completely peaceful organization that will never again be anything to do with any kind of intimidation or that sort of stuff. But I do think that they've realized that at least for now, they need to definitely keep their powder dry on this one. Because as IRR polling and as polling done by other organizations, you know, like Afrobarometer and stuff finds, people are in South Africa pretty sick of chaos and pretty keen on stability and growth and all those good things, because people don't, you know, South Africa is not fundamentally a revolutionary country where we have a revolutionary population demanding that, you know, the bourgeoisie's heads be cut off from their shoulders and that sort of thing. So I think this is quite interesting and definitely from the court, the right move. Okay, let's move on to... speaking of disorder, let's move on to our next story. And this is about Pick It Up, which is the waste collection company in Johannesburg. And there's been a little bit of reporting on this. The details are a bit confused because I've heard a version of the story from the ground, which is slightly different in the details. But the media reports that Pick It Up says its services were disrupted on Thursday last week due to a number of casual workers who worked for the organization who were demanding permanent jobs and essentially blocked the delivery of services, of waste collection services across large parts of Johannesburg. Version of the story I heard is that there were a number of positions open for casual workers at a Pick It Up depot. I think it was something like 6 or 7 positions open. More than 200 people showed up to try and apply for those positions. Then as the crowd was being managed, a rumor spread through it that some people had been given the jobs already and that those people had paid a 5,000 rand bribe in order to secure those casual jobs, at which point there was essentially a riot and people blocked the way. You can see some of the sentiment coming out in quotes from the people who were preventing the delivery of these services, saying, "We demand to know the criteria they used to shortlist the successful candidates." So I think this is one of those stories, you know, it's not a huge deal. It's a very short strike. It only seems to have disrupted waste collection services in parts of Joburg for a day or two. But this really shows the shocking levels of desperation out there, that you have just a few positions open for work and hundreds of people turn up. And there are lots of stories like this across South Africa, particularly in rural areas. You know, you'll have a factory that decides it's going to hire a few more people, and 10, 20, 30 times the number of positions open in candidates show up at the front gate desperately seeking work opportunities, even if they don't really have much of a chance of getting one. And I think this kind of shines a spotlight on what has unfortunately become very normal, John, in our society, is the degree to which unemployment has a real human cost that causes enormous amounts of misery in our society.
Yeah. So as we were choosing stories, I thought maybe this one is too local, because the three of us on the show today live in Johannesburg. So I'm certainly affected by this. I don't know if the two of you are. Yes.
I don't appear to have been myself.
Okay. Well, then we know where to drop our trash off. We'll come and visit you. But yeah, the thing is, of course, that the implications are much, much larger than just parts of Johannesburg. And it's much along the lines of what you say. So in recent times, doing briefings to CEOs and executives at companies, I preface my briefing by saying that, you know, we'll do questions and answers afterwards. But the answer to almost any question you ask me is going to be economic growth, because that is actually what's going to solve almost anything that bothers you. And either it's the growth itself that fixes the problems that afflict us, or it is the necessary conditions you have to put in place in order to receive the economic growth as the outcome that will address the things that afflict us. And this Pick It Up story is a microcosm of that. You know, as you say, there are so many people out there who are desperate to work, for whom social grants and 350 rands per month are no substitute. You know, as much as the government might want to present it as that, as providing dignity and, you know, a way to have a living even without earning one, it is not a substitute. Ultimately, what people need is a way to provide for themselves, and that means that they need work and they need a job. And to get that, we need the economic growth, which is where that standard answer comes in. That's what we always need. So as localized and as small as this incident may seem, its implications reach far beyond Johannesburg, throughout the entire rest of the country. And what it is saying is that the country needs more growth so that we can produce the jobs that will give the desperate people queuing in their thousands for a few paltry job offers an opportunity to find something better in their lives. Nick.
Right. I mean, in this case, you know, we're not even talking about permanent jobs. We're talking about temporary casual work that people were lining up in their thousands. And possibly, because I think there may in fact even be some credibility to rumors that people are paying bribes. Can you imagine paying a 5,000 rand bribe for a job that in total is probably only going to earn you something like 20,000 rand over the course of several months or maybe even a year? That just demonstrates how desperate people are. But Sarah, you know, I want to take maybe a slightly different angle on this one, which is that I'm often very frustrated by how our sort of political commentary and media and lots of things in the country talk about South African elections. You know, I'm thinking about the stories that have been most in the headlines up to this election. There's been the legal issues around Zuma and MK. There's been this discussion of the DA's flag advert and, you know, whether it was okay to burn the flag. And yet, when you actually look at what people care about, the vast majority of people care about unemployment. In surveys that the IRR has done, but also that other organizations have done, found that unemployment is by far the most pressing issue that people demand. And I think there's only been one media news cycle that has actually focused on unemployment, and that was when the DA and Kosatu had a fight about the minimum wage. But that lasted like 3 or 4 days. And then we went back to the usual sort of constitutional court says this about Zuma, electoral court says this about MK. You know, the DA is disrespecting the flag, et cetera, et cetera. Do you agree with me that we're kind of missing the point, considering that, you know, we're just over a week until the elections happen, and yet we're still kind of not talking about the main issue?
Well, I suppose it serves as a pre-election parable for the crux of the matter of the election. It's about people wanting and deserving more than they're getting from their government, and employment, earning your own money, having the dignity of holding a job and bringing in money, and to a greater or less extent, improving the quality of your life, is basic. It's not a huge demand. It's not an unreasonable demand. But it's symptomatic of so much of what we're not getting, what opportunities people cannot use to improve their lives. It's as basic as they come. And I mean, essentially the appeal is to people to vote. Don't worry about what people are voting, what other people are doing, or whether they feel comfortable in the political scenario. When it comes to voting, you vote your needs. And in this country, from the studies we've done, you'll find that probably the vast majority of people who vote based on what they need in their lives, first and foremost, will be the same, and it will be employment, for employment. because with employment and with earning, you have possibilities. On 350 Rand a month, which I think that the fact that the ANC sees this as a sort of achievement is almost obscene, and the dependency that it implies, nothing happens, nothing grows. So it's really about looking at what is the best possibility for me to improve my lot. Who do I think, however one may think of the political parties on an ideological level, who will make the difference in my life? The chances are that it would be the same party or parties that would make a change in most people's lives.
John, your final thoughts on this?
Yeah, just a punt for friend of the IRR, Big Daddy Liberty. So he's out on the road at the moment, interviewing ordinary South Africans on the elections and what sort of issues mainly drive their interest. And I've looked at a couple of these clips, and it really is remarkable how big the problem of unemployment is and how many people mention that as the main issue. So we see it in our polling, but, you know, seeing statistics is one thing. But seeing actual people out in the street, you know, being asked at random what they care about and repeatedly, without fail, again and again, saying jobs and unemployment is the biggest problem, really is very impactful. So do go check out his channel, Big Daddy Liberty.
Yeah, definitely. One of the few people kind of who seems to be going around and doing that sort of man on the street stuff right now in our media space. All right, let us move overseas for a change for our last story. And this is the kind of shocking news, because this really doesn't happen often. The president of Iran, Ebrahim Raisi, has died in a helicopter crash in Iran, along with Iran's foreign minister. Now, on first appearance, if you don't know that much about Iran, this might seem like it's very monumental for the politics of Iran, that this is going to be a huge shift. And it's definitely important for Iran's politics, but it's actually not as big of a deal as one might realize on first viewing, because Iran is controlled not by its president, but by a person called the supreme leader. In this case, his name is Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, the president of Iran was widely expected to be the potential successor to the supreme leader. In Iran, you are only allowed to run for president if you are approved by the supreme leader as a candidate. So as you can imagine, while they do have elections, and they are in some ways competitive, the elections almost always tend to be between two or three kind of supreme leader approved candidates, which means there's not a lot of political variety in how that country is run. Anyway, his passing is very likely to cause some internal ructions and conflict, I suspect, within the Iranian government. But beyond that, I don't think it's going to see much of a change of policy across the wider region, particularly from Iran. The Iranian president was widely regarded as very much a hardliner, even within the Iranian government, which tends to be pretty hardline in general. He came to fame in 1988 when he got the nickname the Butcher of Tehran after violently suppressing an anti-government protest there. He also was a big proponent of Iran's nuclear weapons program, its uranium enrichment, its expansion across the Middle East into Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. He supported its actions, support for the enemies of Israel. He is likely to be succeeded. He's been succeeded by the vice president for now. There will be fresh elections held, which are expected to be won by the supreme leader's son, who shares his surname Khamenei. So, Sara, let me start with you. What do you make of this story? Am I correct to perhaps downplay some of the importance of this to international politics? What do you make of this?
I'm inclined to agree with the downplay from the point of view of the affecting or benefiting the Iranian society. It's not going to do that. It's a hard line doesn't begin to describe this government. And it's going, because you've got a government run by a clerisy and the supreme leader in particular, who has to be a cleric, it's going to be a matter of possibly a bit of infighting. Do they take his son on the one hand? you know, you've got the play for the sort of succession battle. On the other hand, Khomeini and Khamenei, in their when the Ayatollah Khomeini was still alive, they agreed that one of the what made the Shah's reign illegitimate was automatic succession through the family.
Hereditary rule, yeah.
Yeah, hereditary rule. So this is, you know, it would be a bit hypocritical, but you know, you're dealing with a very autocratic regime, so anything is possible. And of course, for the son, what's crucial is the appointment would secure his future once his father dies, and his father has been very ill. So that's a very immediate possibility. And the chances are, in a regime of this nature, once his father goes, he is by no means secure. Unless he's in a position like president. There's even rumors that this was, in fact, an assassination from within the government, exactly to make sure that this issue is resolved ahead of Khomeini's death. So it being the regime it is, and anything is possible. Though it's still, you know, you could never discount the wags who say that the Mossad put a big mountain in the way of the helicopter that that contained Raisi and the foreign minister when it crashed. But you know, this is very much the workings of not just the clerisy, but also the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is unbelievably effective, very, very well trained, and has become extraordinarily dominant in the political in life of
politics. Yeah, the closed nature of these regimes and their very undemocratic system kind of lends it fuels sort of conspiracy theory and plots and all that sort of stuff. Because as you say, you know, when you have such a closed society like this, when you have so much to play for and so much power concentrated in so few hands, there's a lot of people who suddenly are very interested in bumping off their political opponents, whether that be the enemies of Iran in Israel or other countries in the Middle East, or maybe someone within the government, as you said, because you know, the loser in these internal power struggles usually doesn't come out too well, let's just say. John, what do you make of this story? Do you agree with my framing? What do you think of this?
Yeah, and I think it is especially interesting because of the entire regional context. So I think Iran really is a key power in that area. You might even argue that the key to Middle East peace lies not in Israel, but in Iran, because it is Iran that supports Hezbollah, that supports Hamas itself as well, and is responsible, therefore, for much of the violence and turmoil that racks that region. So a change of orientation of regime in Iran, I think, would have very far-reaching consequences for the entire region, for peace or violence in that area. And the question really then becomes, where is Iran going to head after this? So maybe three scenarios. The one is continuity and stability. So it's a continuation of the regime we've got at the moment. The second would be a civil war, so fighting spilling out and, you know, just generally a great deal of upheaval without a clear resolution. And maybe the third alternative would be a regime change towards a less autocratic regime, sort of the notion being that the protests that Iran has experienced in recent years over the desire for liberation from the very autocratic rules imposed by the mullahs would succeed. And I think depending on which of these outcomes you get, it has implications for Israel and for the neighboring countries as well. From my point of view, probably the first scenario is the likeliest, which I think is stability, because as Sarah points out, those Revolutionary Guards have got a proper hold on the country. They are not reluctant to use violence in order to stay in power. And therefore, I think they do hold the upper hand, and that is the likeliest outcome. But nonetheless, you know, if you're a watcher of the region, keep a close eye on what's going on there, because there could be unexpected outcomes and results, including some that are quite hopeful. So if you've got that third result with a regime change and a kind of liberation, I think that would be good for the people of Iran, but also very good for the region. Nick?
Yeah, I think that's I pretty much agree with that. There have been the protests against the Iranian government have been pretty widespread for at least 10 years now, actually. although they have had relatively little success in actually being able to change government policy in any sort of way. And in fact, in the last year, we've seen hundreds of protesters condemned to death. We've seen thousands arrested and put in prison. So, yeah, I suspect continuity is the most likely outcome of all this, despite this unexpected development. But I think it is a reminder of, you know, with the increasingly complicated and difficult world we're living in at the moment, of how unexpected events do happen. And you never really know entirely what the outcome of them is going to be. Sara, any final thoughts before we close up for today?
Yeah, just to say, I think that for the third hopeful scenario that John mentioned, the only way one's going to get that is, in fact, if a country like America stops supporting Iran financially and allowing its economy to grow, because it's only, I believe, those outside forces that would weaken the rulers of Iran, the IRGC, because that's the thing they don't have control of. What they do have control of is the means to keep the populace down. And despite that, there were celebrations in some quarters, even in Iran, over Raisi's death. So, you know, the Iranians are, you know, you can never discount them.
All right. And on that note, let us call this to a close. We hope that you found this show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow, of course, with a Daily Friend wrap. Cheers, everyone. Also, before I forget, do check out the launch of a paper that the Institute of Race Relations is doing tomorrow about the economic prospects of the manifestos of the ANC and DA. So do have a look at that. That should be at about 10 o'clock on the IRR's YouTube page, which is not this one. You can look, find that Institute of Race Relations on YouTube. Anyway, thank you very much. We hope you all have a wonderful day.